Dr. Thank you for your wonderful presentation and overview. I think there's a question from the audience at
yes.
the left.
Thank you. I heard Dr. Locke from Toronto spoke in the ASN meeting in 2017 about the mislabeling of AV graft as bad AV fistula is good. And she indicated that most of the studies which looked at AV fistula outcome versus graft had taken out the initial failure. Then what we are comparing only the 60% of fistula which matures comparing to the graft. Then do you feel that graft is not applicable or a plausible option? I use AV graft on all elderly patients, which minimize catheter rate, minimize weight, and it works well.
No, I think it's AV graft is a valuable second alternative. I think if you've ruled out that you know a patient, given patient, is not a candidate for an AV fistula, I think you should definitely consider alternatives. And these days, newer graft materials that are coming out are better and better. I've not seen the results yet of grafts that actually are created with endothelial linings from humans, human endothelial lined AV graft materials that are very biocompatible. And I think in the future you may see more of those kinds of things. So I think, but whenever you look at outcomes, all the studies will suggest, and I agree that some of the studies that compared them directly did not take into account the early failures, the surgical, primary surgical failures, technique failures. And again, the surgeon is important for that, right? So it's not like it's destined to fail. It's the expertise of the surgeon. So if you have the right people doing your procedure in the right person with all the pre-operative workup. Pre-operative workup has been emphasized a lot. I have not seen enough papers on the intraoperative techniques yet that ensure success. We've seen pre-op and post-op workup and papers on that in the HFM study, for example, but not enough information has yet come out from the surgeons who do their job and then come out. They don't actually document what's the cause for their success or not, or lack thereof. But I agree with you that, you know, if it's not that you have to have a failed fistula before you consider a graft. I think graft should be considered up front in the right circumstance, but should not be your first go in an elderly person.
May I have another question? Have we looked at the effect of AV fistula on right heart failure and pulmonary hypertension in patients? Thank you.
When you say we have not looked at that in the USRDS, but I know of studies suggesting that AV fistula obviously raises cardiac output and has an effect on LV performance, creates a remodeling of the entire cardiovascular system and affects both the vessels as well as the heart. And it's the upper arm AV fistula that's worse off in this regard. That's more. So another, you know, why are we moving away when we can create something more distally? Why do we jump straight to a proximal location just because we know it's easier? Technique-wise, it's easier and there is more. But you lose options for the patient. And it's actually bad practice to not use the distal arm at all. And steel is more common with upper arm. Heart failures can be worsened or can be worse with upper arm fistulae. Yes, there's short-term success, but there's a price to be paid with upper arm fistulae and procedures. Right away, to jump from one to not to try out adequately the lower arm.
Okay, we have some questions from the audience or by the card. What do you recommend for monitoring of intervention for those fistulas after transplantation when they are not longer needed? So fistulas after transplantation, what do you do with them?
Yeah, it's a very specific question. Again, I think this should be looked at more in our big data. We should look at this question. Fistulae often close in clinical practice. What I can remember is that fistulae often close spontaneously, but there are some that persist, and it depends on the patient and their clinical scenario. If for example the patient is his or her transplant function is declining, I tend not to recommend closure, or if it's not causing any problems, I tend not to recommend closure. in the anticipation that this person might need dialysis in the future. But if it's causing problems and the transplant's working great and it's a living donor situation, I would maybe recommend closure, especially if it's causing problems. It's a clinical question, but I'm not aware of large data that have looked at this and examined this question specifically, but it's a great question.
And I give this card, there are three interesting questions for you on one card.
Would you support a move to make surgeon performance public? What are they doing differently in Japan, and how do they not have catheters for hemodialysis? Good questions. Also, are surgeons more skilled in AV fistula placement? They are placing a much higher proportion of lower arm fistulas compared to the rest. I suspect this question pertains to Japan.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
That they are putting more... So, I think if these data get published, it'll attract... I'm not the person who will decide whether a measure gets introduced. The data will speak for themselves, and if CMS should take this on, they could consider making it a quality measure, surgical performance, of what proportion of the fistula that you create, because they are looking for physician-specific metrics. This is a move that in future there will be individual physician or surgeon performance that will be seen more and more in quality metrics, in CKD as well as for ESRD. So it's possible that this could be considered as a measure. I'm sure it will be opposed vehemently. I have a very small role to play in the measure development project, which exists in parallel with the USRDS, but they are completely separated by the contract needs and our responsibilities. So our job in the USRDS is to analyze data and produce the most robust data and research that could impact practice. We don't necessarily do this research in order to create quality measures. But it's conceivable, because there is such a lot of variation in surgical performance, that this might be considered as a performance metric. I can see that. I mean, these data, these graphics are very, very impressive in terms of showing the variability. What are they doing differently in Japan? So I think this is a, so when you consider a large database and you look for variation across within the country or across nations, and this has been hammered on in the literature since the early 2000s. I think it's a... there may be differences. The Japanese may be unique individuals genetically and developmentally, and their vasculature may be different, but I think there's more to it. I think it's their practice patterns and how meticulously they do these procedures in both men and women that they try to achieve. So there may be biological factors, just like... In some of the ethnic minorities, African Americans, for example, fistula failure is more common, and there may be some biological basis to that. Just like the APOL1 gene came along and told us that this is, and partly at least an explanation of why kidney disease is more rampant and more progressive. There may be genetic or other factors that determine outcomes in the Japanese versus the rest of the world, but there may be lessons, and I have not seen hordes of U.S. surgeons trying to go there and learn from what they are doing differently. Maybe to say simply that they are no different. But I have not seen this natural experiment that's on frank display in our publications. We don't seem to be learning from that those differences in practice patterns and why those outcomes are different. So I think it behooves us as a community. For example, intradialytic hypotension is far less common in Japan than in the U.S., and so the reasons for that are currently unclear. I know, Peter, you are interested in looking at IDH. They see it in less than 10% of their patients. And one of the reasons they cite is that they dialyze their patients flat in the bed. So they don't have hypotension, they don't remove large volumes in short times, and they dialyze them flat in bed. So they don't experience the hypotension. They get low blood flow, low UFR, longer treatment times. And quite simply, that is a very nice explanation of why it might be. Now, people have not looked at that in the form of a clinical trial, but observationally, that's one practice they claim is superior. What else? For us, it's sitting in a chair, having exsanguinating volumes being removed in 3.5 to 4 hours, is bound to lead to hypotension in a large proportion of our patients. So 20% or more may have IDH. So maybe there are differences in their practices or what kinds of anastomoses they are trained to make. Maybe they are simple surgeons, but they know exactly how to make the anastomoses, the angle, the aperture, the size of the, and the sutures, the atraumatic nature of their experience. But that needs to be observed to be learned from, I think, and we've not done that. We've not used that as a learning system. We do these observational studies for getting papers out. We don't tend to use it as a learning exercise of what's different and what to do next. I think these are supposed to raise questions for future research, not just for academic reasons, but to actually make a difference. So there may be, it may be that Japanese do things differently that we should learn from. Our surgeons, their surgeons more skilled? I don't think so. I think we have great surgeons. We have great training. But they're not committed to vascular access. In the training phase of U.S. residents for surgery, they do very few vascular access procedures. At least in the DOPS survey we did back in 2008, published in Annals of Surgery, the U.S. surgeons in training were making 15 or so AV fistulas during their entire training period, compared to 50 or more in other countries. So the training experience, which correlated with subsequent outcomes of their the fistula that these surgeons created. So they were asked, how many procedures did you do during training? And then we looked at the ABIM requirements, the American College of Surgery requirements, and they had no specific requirements for vascular access for dialysis in their vascular procedures. It was a combination of things. So they were obviously more interested in doing the carotids and the major fempop bypasses and other major procedures that were more exciting for them. Vascular access was not included. So they may be doing very few vascular access procedures. So these need to be prioritized. These are lifelines for our patients, and we need to find the right surgeons. I think those are the
okay.
questions.
Yeah. Any other questions from the audience? If not, then I would think Dr. Saranfo, it was a wonderful overview.
Thanks.